Welcome to Decaf and Debunk, a podcast all about busting myths and bringing light to popular and sometimes confusing topics in nutrition and health, because we all could use a little less caffeine and a little more science. I'm your host, Jessie.
And I'm Hope.
And today we are going to be talking about a question that I feel like Hope and I get pretty often when we're working with clients or even just interacting with people on social media and just seeing people post about things like this on social media. I've ranted about it a little bit on my page, but it's the topic of electrolyte supplements. Do you need them? We're going to cover kind of what electrolytes are, some indications for their use, some dangers for some populations that might need to look out for them, and kind of debunk everything about electrolytes. Hope, are you excited for this one? I know you deal with this a lot in your area too.
Yeah, I think that hydration ends up being, and electrolytes end up being, maybe hyper-focused on for lactation. I know, maybe we'll talk about it a little later, but there's commonly a blue Gatorade, that comes up on, social media intermittently. So definitely in my population, and it's almost heightened because parents really want to do the best by their children. So if they're breastfeeding, they are concerned with getting enough of micronutrients and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So to kind of get us started, let's just talk about what electrolytes are. So Hope, do you want to kind of give a rundown? We both teach all the biochemistry courses. And so we're going to put on our teaching lecture professor caps for a little bit. But do you want to share kind of what electrolytes are and what they do in our body?
Yeah, we have a lot of different type of electrolytes in our body. The main ones that we end up hearing about or talking about are sodium, and kind of paired with that being potassium. And we've more frequently, I feel like, especially with the electrolyte supplements becoming more popular, there's more conversation about chloride, magnesium, calcium, but our main electrolytes are sodium and potassium. And honestly, they control a ton of things in our body, but someone's body that is healthy and functioning well has extremely tight control over their electrolytes. They don't fluctuate a lot. Having low or high electrolytes very quickly becomes dangerous because some of the things that they contribute to are nerve transmission. So think like your heartbeat. Every time your heart beats, that's a nerve transmission.
Like seizures can occur when you have fall out of this range. Like it's serious. It's not just like, oh, I feel a little fatigued.
Yeah. Kind of thing. And then acid-base balance, which I think on a previous episode, I said one of my pet peeves is when people bring up alkaline water, but acid-base balance is one of those, and where our water is in our body. So it does contribute to hydration. So that's kind of the different types. Do you want to tell a little bit about how those things move around the body?
Yeah, when we talk about just like hydration itself, because I think what we're getting at here is people take electrolytes for a lot of reasons, but usually it's from more of a hydration standpoint. And like you can take magnesium and stuff in pill form, and we utilize it a lot in the GI space because some forms of magnesium have mild laxative properties. In general, when we think about like electrolytes, a lot of times they're just powdered forms that we add to water because the goal is for hydration purposes, with the goal of individuals, like if they're just drinking water, if you like chug a ton of water, you could quote unquote start to dilute your electrolytes in your bloodstream, but it doesn't really work that way. And we'll talk about kind of why, like our body is very tightly regulated outside of something going wrong. But in general, I think what most people will recognize when we're talking about like hydration and the way in which electrolytes influence that is, I think most people will recognize the sodium potassium pump and learning about that through some level of biology. I mean, I think you learn about it starting in like middle school. I mean, maybe even elementary school now, because kids now are so advanced. That's a tangent. But like kids now are way more advanced and learning way more higher things than I even learned in grade school.
Yep.
But whatever.
You're telling me when my stepkids are home and we ask at the dinner table, what'd you learn at school today? Some of the things I'm like, oh, okay. I didn't know we were doing that in second grade, but cool.
I know. Technology is great and it's advanced our students' abilities. I mean, I remember, and we're showing our school brains right now, but I remember in like, I was in like second grade and we had just started to learn how to use like PowerPoints. because it was like new. It was new. Yeah. So I'm dating myself too. But back to the sodium potassium pump that we've all learned about. It really, it controls the movement of sodium and potassium across the cell membrane. So in general, sodium is going to move out of the cell. Potassium is going to move into the cell. These are electrolytes, are called electrolytes because they have an electrical charge associated with them, whether it's positive or negative. Sodium and potassium are both positive, positively charged electrolytes. And so they kind of counteract each other in terms of their movement. They don't really move together in the same direction, because then creating differences in charge across the membrane is how we have like nerve transmission things. But the interesting thing about that movement of sodium and potassium is that water tends to follow sodium. And so this is just like simple kind of like diffusion of, if you move sodium from the inside of the cell into the outside of the cell, in order to kind of balance the water or the concentration of that sodium on either side of the membrane, water is going to move wherever, you know, it needs to be to kind of balance that and maintain it. And so some kind of an example of this to kind of give a little bit more perspective of what I'm talking about. So say we have a really high intake of sodium through the diet. So when we have high intakes of sodium, and it's more tightly controlled than this, so just bear with me. But if we, in theory, have high intakes of sodium, that will increase our essentially kind of like blood levels, or start to teeter it a little bit above. Our body's very tightly regulated to do that. But when it starts to increase, in response, our body is going to move water into the bloodstream to balance out that, because it's like our sodium has to stay within a very specific concentration. And so when it starts to teeter up, it's like our body's like, we got to dilute this. We're going to push water into the bloodstream. That in turn increases your blood volume, which then increases your blood pressure. And so that's one of the main mechanisms by which sodium can increase blood pressure, is because it's just the movement of water to kind of keep that sodium within a very specific concentration. And potassium is really unique in that it does counteract kind of some of those effects, in that we know individuals, when we eat like a higher potassium diet, we tend to kind of counteract with having like lower blood pressure. And that's really just due to that opposition of movement between sodium and potassium, and they kind of just like balance and counteract each other. Yeah. And so the opposite happens with too little sodium. So if you don't consume too much, you're going to move water out of your bloodstream to kind of concentrate that. And we have a lot of mechanisms in place to kind of control that.
And I was going to say, this is for the general population going to be what you see in the like Mrs. Dash, or things that you can cook with that help to reduce sodium but maintain a salty type of flavor. Generally, they're putting potassium in there, or potassium chloride in there, and it maintains the kind of salty flavor, but it's helping to reduce the amount of sodium and subsequently help to, for some people, reduce blood pressure. So if you're like in the grocery store or thinking of ways that you can reduce the amount of sodium in your diet overall, and you're not familiar with using herbs to flavor your food, that's where those exchanges can happen to easily, so people can easily continue in the same cooking style of their culture, et cetera.
Yeah. And we'll get into kind of some populations that may need to pay attention to that. But to kind of, as a spoiler alert, it's not every individual that needs to be like hypervigilant on sodium intakes. And some people may need more, some people may need less, but we'll kind of talk about that in a little bit. So we've kind of covered like basically the very, I mean, I give multiple
iceberg
days lectures on these electrolyte topics. So we spend like an entire week on just sodium and potassium. So, you know, understanding that we're giving you the very snippet top of the iceberg here. Let's talk about, give a little bit more detail on what are some of the really cool mechanisms that exist within our body to control our blood pressure, even in the absence of the like kind of sodium changes. And so I'll let Hope go for it.
Yeah. So as Jesse mentioned, we have some naturally occurring phenomenons like where water follows salt, but we also have really cool metabolic control in these situations. One of those things that happens is our antidiuretic hormone. When your blood pressure actually decreases, we have a secretion of a hormone called antidiuretic hormone, and it tells our body not to release water. So as Jesse mentioned, when we have more water in our blood system, that increases the volume of our blood and helps to increase our blood pressure. So individuals who are dealing with or struggling with low blood pressure, we do tend to encourage not just hydration, but also the intake of electrolytes from foods and, you know, supplements, because it helps to move everything into the blood, right? And kind of help with that balance. So that would be on the side of if your blood pressure was low. But we have a couple of really cool mechanisms also that help to maintain sodium. Specifically, sodium is kind of the one that ends up getting a lot of attention because of how it can be related to blood pressure more tightly or more in a more correlated fashion. So we have actually two different mechanisms. One is going to be a mechanism that is sodium and this, what we call the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone syndrome or system, excuse me, or RAAS. And in metabolism, we call that the RAS system. This is an opposite reaction. So when sodium is too high, your RAS system is going to help with reducing the amount of sodium, and vice versa. So they're moving in the opposite direction. It's helping to control how much of your water is being excreted in your kidneys and going to your urine, or how much sodium is being excreted in your kidneys and so going in the opposite direction, right? Where is that making sense? I'm in my brain, this is making sense.
Yeah, because
you're seeing the metabolism.
You're seeing kind of the metabolic diagram, and I'm following you. I'm trying to see like the easiest way to kind of say this. It's like very similar to what she talked about with antidiuretic hormone, of like when your blood pressure falls, you have this cascade of events that is going to occur that's basically going to result in mechanisms of increasing blood pressure.
And this is a negative regulation feedback
like
system.
Inverse.
So an inverse relationship. Thank you. I was looking for that word.
So when blood pressure starts to fall, you have this increase in this pathway. Mm-hmm. And the overall goal, without breaking it down, that you we call it the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, because it does follow, like, you secrete renin, and then you deal with angiotensin 1 and 2, and then you deal with aldosterone as the result. It's a cascade of events, but eventually increases. The overall goal is to increase your blood pressure.
Right. And then similarly, it will be downregulated. If your blood pressure is to increase, that's going to downregulate your renin-angiotensin-aldosterone cascade that's happening. And so you don't continue to just skyrocket your blood pressure, you know, forever.
And the interesting thing, there were some researchers at where I was getting my PhD that were doing some really unique like work in this area, because this is not a mechanism that has been like known for like an extensive period of time, and it's still being studied. But just kind of understanding that this is what, there's some hypotheses that this is what contributes to or plays a role in individuals being salt sensitive or not, is just this dysfunction or overactive mechanism that can be maybe increasing blood pressure too much, or, you know, not being fully like as active as it should, like basically just dysregulated. And so there's definitely some hypotheses as to why, some individuals just have like chronic high blood pressure, and it's thought to be that that like dysfunction
could
is kind of a role in that. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a second mechanism that actually I went down the rabbit hole yesterday because of the difference between sodium content in cow's milk and human milk when we were kind of preparing for this. And I went down a huge rabbit hole, but I had never heard of this before yesterday and read a couple or skimmed a couple of studies about it. But there's actually a positively regulating mechanism as well that was endogenous albane, which is in the literature was abbreviated EO. But essentially, it is the opposite of the RAS system, that when you don't have enough sodium, this is going to be the molecule that is signaling to keep the sodium inside of your body. And there is a hypothesis that there are individuals that just have naturally occurring high circulating levels of albane. And that would mean they have a hard time excreting their sodium in general, regardless of what their body or intake looks like. So for those individuals, they could have a form of salt-sensitive hypertension whereby their body can't adjust for the fact that they intook more sodium because they naturally have a hard time excreting it. So that's another signaling molecule. But I guess kind of the point we're trying to get at here is that we have a lot of mechanisms in our body that are signaling molecules that are telling your body, okay, we have a little bit too much, or we're going in the positive direction, so it's going to bring it back down. Okay, now we have a little bit too low and it's going to go the other direction. And all of those systems are contributing to the fact that we have extremely tight regulation of our blood electrolytes. And if you are experiencing abnormalities in your electrolytes, that is usually to either something where you're overworked, like you've stressed your system to a point where you aren't able to maintain your homeostasis anymore. Mm-hmm.
So with that biochemistry lesson, you can follow along with us by Googling, Googling quick, like RAS system or antidiuretic hormone and seeing some of those pathways.
Yeah. And also I think this would be a good time to invite, we learned that you can leave comments and we get them. We saw some comments from previous podcast. So also, if there are any things that you want or you're curious about, want to be clarified, etc., totally leave a comment, because we understand this for us. I can see it in my brain, and for other people might be more difficult.
And then what our plan is with those comments as they start to kind of roll in is we'll have like an AMA, Ask Me Anything kind of episode. Basically, we'll break down, spend an episode kind of going over the contents. So kind of transitioning a little bit, we're going to kind of move into like talking about some more practical information. Where can we find like electrolytes?
Yeah, obviously it's becoming very popularized that you can get them in electrolyte supplements, but they are naturally occurring elements in foods, like pretty much all foods. We see fruits and veggies honestly are extremely nutrient dense. So whenever we talk about any of these types of nutrients, we are going to be able to find them in fruits and veggies because they have lots and lots of nutrients in it, in them. But like a lot of foods, and especially if you are where we are in the US, specifically with sodium, we end up seeing a lot of sodium in the diets of individuals living in the United States because of the amount of processed foods that we consume as a society. And one of the ways that we can preserve foods is through salting. So it helps to improve shelf life when we add salt to things. And so frozen items are generally going to have salt added. Shelf stable items definitely are going to have salt added. And it is a preservation mechanism that we're using so that people can still access the food and, you know, it doesn't get moldy, etc. In the US, we very commonly see that people are getting electrolytes in plenty of volume, minus some, like we talked about, we're going to talk about some specific populations, but the general population can very easily access electrolytes in their diet through foods in general.
Yeah. And we, like sodium in general, kind of what we end up educating individuals on, we work one-on-one, sodium is very abundant, or can be very abundant in our diet. It's very rare that I'm working with someone outside of someone that has like an eating disorder or disordered eating that they're not consuming enough sodium, because you eat a couple of more packaged, or I mean even canned and some frozen stuff, like you eat some of that, you usually get an adequate amount. Where people tend to fall short on the other side is more of like potassium. So potassium is a little more difficult to get. It's not just like added to foods as like, you know, I mean, some of it can be in preservation mechanism, but not to the same extent as sodium. But where we find potassium is in like fruits and veggies for the most part. And so that's where like, you know, people get really focused on like these nitpicky things. But from a big perspective, just kind of some of doing some of the very basic things like eating enough fruits and veggies. Yeah, that's only going to help a lot of different areas of your overall health. including like helping regulate blood pressure and regulate GI motility and, you know, keep inflammation low in the body. And
I was going to say, I know this kind of ties back to our last carbs are important, but potatoes are an excellent source of potassium. So those of you that are loving your, when we did the rank your carbs, loving potatoes as your carb, it has great, great levels of potassium in there for you.
Yeah, there's actually populations that we have to limit potassium in, and those are like individuals with like chronic kidney disease. And one of the first things that, you know, individuals, when we're working, teaching dietetic students and stuff, that like one of the first things they have to kind of educate on is like potatoes are really high in potassium. Because I think a lot of people are just like potassium bananas. It's not just bananas. And actually there's other things that are much higher in potassium. Like potatoes have a really high amount, and you can very easily overdo potassium with potatoes. Fruits and veggies like that. I mean, that's really just kind of getting at the balance of like, yes, sodium is really abundant in our like standard kind of typical diet. If we are not like only eating very like fresh
specific
whole foods. And then potassium tends to be a little lower, but the good thing is like, maybe we eat a little less processed foods, a little more like fruits, veggies, and things like that. And that'll balance that out. It doesn't have to be overly complicated. And so that all to say that you find sodium, potassium, and then even things like magnesium and some of our other electrolytes pretty decently in food. And it's not that common that people are going to have to supplement in order to get adequate amounts to meet the RDA or the recommended daily allowance for those.
Yeah.
Foods.
And I was going to say, we actually see in the literature, I know electrolyte supplements end up being a really hot topic for athletes in general. And that's one of the populations that we're going to talk about. But for the average individual who is participating in, you know, the 150 minutes of moderate exercise a week, water and a banana has been shown to rehydrate to the same extent as, you know, grabbing a Powerade or a Gatorade. So depending on, you know, and the supplements or the drinks like Powerade, Gatorade, those can be expensive compared to drinking a glass of water and grabbing a banana or making sure you have some potatoes in your dinner, et cetera. So for
or
those
just
of you
having
that are
something that has a little bit of salt in it. I mean, like it's gross, but like you can salt your water, like, or, you know,
that's all they're doing with Gatorade.
Yeah. It's just a little flavored. I mean, it is, it's just salty water, with some flavors in it. So kind of transitioning into basically kind of what we're already moving into naturally. What are some populations that are going to need more sodium and may actually benefit from taking an electrolyte supplement?
Yeah. So like I mentioned, probably the most common population that we end up seeing this conversation in is athletes. And generally as dietitians, where we start to make adjustments to the way that people are accessing electrolytes is really with elite endurance athletes, not the kids playing soccer on a Saturday afternoon, right? Not saying it's a bad thing to have Powerade or Gatorade, whatever, or an electrolyte beverage. It's definitely not going to hurt. But with the populations in that are elite endurance athletes, those individuals can actually have very dangerous concerns if they are not properly rehydrating and refueling their electrolytes, like how we mentioned earlier, seizures. If your sodium drops too low, you can end up having a seizure, cardiac arrest or arrhythmias that can happen. And generally we see those in, you know, what think like the Tour de France, cyclists, the people who are running marathons, Ironman type of athletes, or, you know, people
Like in the South, football is a big thing, and, and it's very hot, and they have to wear a lot of equipment, especially like if they're doing like practice in the summer and stuff like that. Those individuals, it's very important to kind of refuel. And it's a very common practice to have those individuals weigh in and weigh out like before and after practice to see how much water they've lost, and then to figure out, okay, how much water do we need to refuel with, but then also kind of estimate like electrolyte needs in refueling too.
I was going to say that's a really good point, because it's also going to vary a little bit, because if you have athletes that, for example, I grew up in Connecticut. So let's just say in Connecticut are practicing somewhere in August or September, like football, the high school football players, or that's going to be a very different situation than when we're in South Carolina and we have people in full gear and they are outside in the sun. So the other population that's really going to need to pay a little bit more attention to this is excessive sweat loss, which that's why generally we kind of liken that to endurance athletes. But that could also be that you are an avid runner and it happens to be 115 degrees in South Carolina on a random, even if it's 5 a.m., sometimes we end up having that high of, and it's also a very humid day. So, you know, you're pouring sweat out. That's the other time we can see that become an issue.
Yeah. And then there are actually ways that these more elite athletes can actually quantify how much they're sweating. So there are ways to calculate their like sweat rate and ways to actually study that. And a lot of teams and programs will utilize those things to make sure they're refueling properly. Because when those electrolytes do get too low or get out of whack, essentially that like can reduce performance because you're dealing with, I mean, like fatigue. Nerve transmission, muscle contraction, like all of these things that are very important for overall function. And so,
I was going to say one thing too, we've kind of talked about some of the extreme symptoms, but for the beginning stages of that, it's going to look similar to like dehydration where there's fatigue, there could be dizziness. Usually if we're reaching the stage of like loss of consciousness, seizures, that's gone like really far. So in general, if you're looking for more typical signs and symptoms of like, hey, I need to hydrate a bit, that's going to be on the more or the less extreme side of like, yeah, some dizziness, potentially thirst is going to be actually your very first mechanism, right? That your body's signaling thirst. And that sounds very, very simple, but this is how your body starts that cascade is, well, let's just tell them that we're thirsty. And if we, you know, can drink to thirst for a typical individual, that would be enough. So thirst is going to be your first, and then, you know, fatigue or dizziness or, you know, muscle, like your muscles are feeling like they're not performing to their highest level.
And some of these things can also occur when we're not properly fueling with actually calories and carbohydrates. And so one of the things that, just kind of getting on a little bit of a tangent here, is looking at a lot of the electrolyte supplements on the market. There are varying different ones, some that have really high levels of sodium, some that are a little more moderate. But I see like this common marketing of just like, we're sugar free, we don't have any sugar. And like, yeah, there is something to like, we don't want to be consuming like tons of amounts of added sugar. But I would push back on that, especially in the populations that we're talking about who need more electrolytes, really thinking about athletes. And that's where a lot of these electrolyte supplements are marketed towards. These individuals actually are going to benefit from having a little extra carbs, and the carbs that are actually in some of the like mainstream like electrolyte supplements are like, it's not a ton. So, I mean, it's going to be just a tiny bit that might tap you out a little bit, your like glucose levels. But I think that's kind of a misconception that it's electrolyte supplements are healthier if they don't contain sugar. But in reality, the individuals that really probably need these electrolyte supplements, thinking more like athletes, would actually benefit from some of that.
Yeah. And depending on at what point in their physical activity they're at, they actually might need the sugar, because if their glycogen stores are running low or they're doing like longer term aerobic activity, we need glucose for that to maintain performance. And actually, I had a really funny story. A friend of mine, or someone that I had known, was a very avid cycler and also had a PhD in nutrition science, because those are the people that I end up knowing. But he was cycling with his brother, and his brother didn't have a PhD in nutrition science, and they like kind of stopped. They were road cycling, stopped at a grocery store, and he sent his brother in like, grab us a couple of Gatorades because it's hotter than I thought. I think we're going to need the extra. And his brother came out with Gatorade Zero, and he got extremely, I keep using these terms. I actually, electrolyte supplement in general, I keep saying Gatorade, Powerade. We don't endorse a specific electrolyte beverage, but in this situation, his brother came out with Gatorade Zero and he had a very serious, like, are you kidding me right now? Like, go return the Gatorade Zero. We need carbohydrates in this moment. That's not going to help. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are situations where like a no sugar could be helpful. So like there's definitely other populations that need more electrolytes. And mm-hmm. so thinking about things like individuals that struggle with like chronic low blood pressure or chronic hypotension, just like low blood pressure. And so you have to continually kind of eat sodium mm-hmm. Or a way to help increase your blood pressure is to kind of make sure you're staying on top of eating things that are salted. Mm-hmm. Another one we've seen a lot of is POTS. Mm-hmm. POTS is pretty like common. Individuals will be kind of asked to kind of stay on top of their sodium levels. And for those individuals, they don't necessarily need more sugar. They right. just need more sodium. And so like having something that is a sugar-free option can be helpful for those individuals. Where I really just get frustrated is just like I'm thinking more so, so you keep saying Gatorade and Powerade, and in my brain, I'm thinking the powdered electrolyte supplements that I see marketed everywhere, and everyone and their mother has like an affiliate code with these companies.
I was actually going to add that's a fantastic point though, because there are also conditions in which you would actually not want the liquid. You actually need like a food source or a concentrated source of those electrolytes, because when the individual is, say, for example, you know, having trouble with their blood pressure or wanting to maintain their electrolytes, and they fluid load at the same time, mm-hmm. but their body is retaining fluid for whatever reason, mm-hmm. That actually would be a situation in which we would focus on food sources, concentrated food sources of electrolytes. And we were just literally, if people looked at my phone, they would be like, you are an extreme nerd, because I have so many examples of, oh, I was just talking to someone about this, but literally last week we're talking about dill pickles if someone needs to replete but can't do fluids because they're retaining fluids for whatever reason, dill pickles, mm-hmm. soy sauce, those are concentrated forms of electrolytes that don't also come with the fat, with the huge boost of water at the same mm-hmm. time, because maybe that individual doesn't need the liquid.
Yeah. So what we're basically getting at here is like, it's not one size fits all, which mm-hmm. I think we see a lot from these. And I think that's what I was trying to get at earlier, is just these supplement companies. I mean, Gatorade and Powerade are not out there marketing towards everyone, but I'm thinking about the ones that I'm seeing on social media right now. It's marketed really towards like everyone, like right. we're not having enough sodium. Everyone could benefit from more sodium. And honestly, that is, I've had conversations with other dietitians and like cardiologists and people like that. And they're like, that's dangerous to like mm-hmm. have that marketing without having some clarity kind of around, like there are populations that need to watch sodium, and we have decades of research that is supporting this. And mm-hmm. I feel like there are even these, I'm thinking of these companies, and I kind of went down a rabbit hole. Like they have pages on their website where they're talking about kind of the science behind like sodium and electrolytes mm-hmm. and why everyone needs more of them. But then like scrolling through there, like they're cherry picking data. Right. And the really funny thing was like when I was scrolling through the other day, they were complaining about like national organization cherry picking data, but then they were cherry picking data in response to that. And it was just, I think there's valid in like pushing back on science and saying like, yeah, science can change and can be wrong, but mm-hmm. there's also validity in the fact that all of the major medical bodies, like mm-hmm. we're talking about like the American Heart Association, like all of these medical bodies and national and worldwide organizations are saying sodium can be an issue for a lot of people. Sodium can increase, cause complications for individuals, especially if they have hypertension already, which about 50% of people in the US have hypertension. Mm-hmm. And so I think there needs to be more nuance and clarity around these topics. And I don't think that's translating over to social media when you see these influencers promoting these supplements and basically saying like, oh, I wake up in the morning and I'm downing a ton, like a really salty electrolyte beverage. Mm-hmm. And maybe I work out, but I'm not like super active, or, and I don't fall into one of these categories, but everyone needs more salt.
Yeah.
And I think that's just dangerous for some people because the messaging does not convey the nuance around the topic.
Yeah. And I'll give you a very funny, well, also annoying, but funny example of this is in the breastfeeding community, there is this it is a cherry picking that happened. There's a message that goes around that people that are breastfeeding or lactating, if you increase your salt consumption, you will make more milk. And I laugh because I know that the majority of quote unquote it's factual for cows. We have actually a ton of research on bovine milk production and goat milk production because the food technology industry has the resources for that. But the translation from a cow to a human is not always one-to-one. And actually, quite a bit of the really convincing research on sodium intake and increased milk production is actually in rats. But it does also help with cows. But then here's where this is the rabbit hole I went down. But here's where it's interesting is when you look at how cows make milk, they have higher endogenous levels of albumin, which we talked about earlier, because their milk has four times as much sodium in it as human milk. So they are needing to replete sodium at a higher level because they are moving all the sodium into their milk. Humans don't do that. We move some sodium, but not in the levels that cows do in their milk. And you know, this is where bodies in general become just so fascinating because it's like, how did that cow's body versus my body know how to do this differently? But it just does. And that's what the cow needs. That's what the human baby needs, et cetera. But that's a really good example of the nuance. If you were to cherry pick and follow the data all the way back, it's like, yeah, we do have some evidence that increased sodium intake can increase milk production in a cow. We're not cows. So, I mean, we need a little bit of, if you actually follow the data and then think, okay, interesting, because we also have really good science where we say, oh, this is happening in an animal model. Let's then go one step further and see, does this happen in a human model? And if we follow those steps and the science that way, we can actually get really cool science and outcomes that is going from a cell model to an animal model to a human model. But this is not that. This one example, if you follow it, follow the line, it's not, oh, it's like, okay, well, that doesn't happen to be true for humans. So that's one example of a nuanced, more nuanced.
To kind of ask a clarifying question to just be more direct about this, what are the recommendations for individuals that are pregnant and are breastfeeding? What are their like recommendations for hydration and electrolyte kind of beverages?
So actually for pregnancy and lactation, sodium intake does not, or requirements don't change. We actually even have situations where even if someone is having high blood pressure due to pregnancy, we don't change their sodium intake because we know the baby needs access to electrolytes as well, number one.
Yeah.
The two things that do change for lactation specifically, number one is the amount of water that someone needs. And it's actually almost a liter more than when they're not pregnant, which is kind of cool because your body is making milk and milk is 80 some percent water. And so you need almost a liter more of water. And if you look at what the average individual makes in milk a day, it's about 750 mils. So almost a liter. That's pretty cool. And then potassium needs are increased, which makes sense because we want to maintain our, you know, electrolyte balance. And if we're moving a lot of water into the mammary glands because we're making milk, we need to focus on that. I did, when I was kind of going down that rabbit hole, wonder if the sodium requirements, I would have to look more into the research that informs the RDAs, but I do in general wonder if public health organizations are hesitant to recommend any type of increased sodium because we know there are lots of populations that that could potentially be harmful for. And we know also in the US that people are generally getting enough sodium in their diet, but I didn't get all the way down the rabbit hole to be able to say, like, interesting.
And then I think the problem with, we've talked about this a lot with this population specifically, and why there's not a lot of research is because they're a vulnerable population. Individuals that are pregnant and or breastfeeding and infants are considered really vulnerable populations, and conducting research on them is very difficult, if not almost impossible sometimes. Just due to ethical reasons, because you can't recruit pregnant individuals or breastfeeding individuals and put them on the, like, extensive supplements or tell someone to not have a lot of sodium and then give the other, like, it's just not ethical. And so I think there needs to be a little bit of, especially, and I know that some of these electrolyte supplements are marketing towards these populations. I just would caution individuals to, it's really important to work one-on-one with your medical provider, understanding the specific nuances that exist with your individual case, and not just blindly following an influencer or a company just because they say, here's the science. I'm just going to tell you now that, like, there's more nuance that needs to go into that, and it needs to be more individualized, because especially with those populations, there's more at stake than just your own personal body. You're taking care of another living being, and there needs to be more care there.
And I will say, so for transparency and clarity, because we don't have a ton of great research, because it wouldn't be ethical, that also lends itself to relying more heavily on things like blood work if you're making specific recommendations. So, you know, working a lot, I work alongside a lot of primary care providers that will run blood work, repeat blood work when we're seeing symptoms of, like, hey, I'm, you know, having fatigue or I'm having dizziness. And we're like, oh, okay. And we're cautiously approaching, like, do we need to make sure we're getting enough hydration and electrolytes? We are also working with their primary care providers to run labs and do repeat labs so that we aren't treading into a space where, you know, we're causing blood pressure issues or electrolyte issues. We definitely work as a part of a care team in that scenario.
So to kind of wrap up and just summarize what we've kind of talked about, we kind of talked in a bunch of circles there, but kind of TLDR, who needs, so basically the individuals, populations that are most commonly going to require more sodium, we're thinking athletes, individuals with really high sweat rates, individuals with things like POTS or chronically low blood pressure, and then other identifiable genetic metabolic conditions that exist, which your doctor should be informed on this. And if your doctor is not having these conversations with you, get a second opinion, find another doctor. And then populations to need to pay more attention to maybe limiting sodium. We think a lot of individuals with things like hypertension, which again, I said, it's estimated like 50% of individuals in the US have that. Individuals that are dealing with things like heart failure and having issues regulating body fluids without their throughout their body. And then individuals with like chronic kidney disease, because our kidneys are in the pathways that we talked about, like the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone or RAS system, your kidneys are really central to kind of maintaining that. And so when you have like deficits in kidney function, sometimes you will have to limit things like that. But again, to kind of all to say, work with your doctor. Don't blindly trust these like electrolyte supplement claims that you see influencer influencers promote, or you just read about online. It is like, hypertension is not a joke. It's like one of the leading causes of like heart disease and like can lead to some serious complications. And so it's not something you want to mess around with. And so keeping tabs on your own kind of health and understanding, am I salt sensitive? Am I not salt sensitive? And, you know, keeping tabs on blood pressure, blood work, all that kind of stuff, and not blindly making big changes to your diet or supplement regime.
So two things before we log off until next time. But number one is that we would love, as I mentioned earlier, for you to engage with us in the Q&A section, because like Jesse mentioned, we'd love to do some AMA episodes and make sure that we're getting our message across clearly and that we're clarifying things for people. And then if you are interested in more educational support resources, you can go to grovenutritioncollective.com. We have free and paid memberships that give you access to resources in that talk about a lot of different areas of general health. So you can engage with us there. You can like our Instagram pages at Grove Nutrition Collective or at Decaf and Debunk and engage with us there. So until next time, stay responsibly caffeinated and reasonably skeptical of nutrition and health claims you see online. Bye.
Bye.